Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is Scott Weinberg, and I am, as always, joined by my co-host, Dr. Steven DeGennaro. But we also have another special guest with us. Steven, who's here?
We have another Dr. DeGennaro in the house. My baby brother, Dr. Vince DeGennaro.
Hey, y'all. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Vince is, unlike myself, Vince is an actual doctor, like the kind of doctor that could give you drugs or cut you open and make you better, as opposed to me, the fake doctor of astrophysics. My little brother is a medical doctor.
He is in internal medicine. He has a master's degree in global public health. Vince, you've been working overseas recently. Where have you been working and what's that like?
Yeah, I've worked in 9 countries over the last 20 years. I lived in Rwanda. I currently live in Haiti. And I've lived in Haiti for the last 7 years. And then I've worked, you know, a couple disaster recovery efforts like in Puerto Rico and recently in the Bahamas.
That's an interesting way to get in. How does a natural disaster foster or lead to disease?
Yeah, I mean, I saw this in Haiti in 2010 after the earthquake, in Haiti, the hurricanes in 2016. What ends up happening is you have a bunch of people who are evacuated from their homes, who had toilets or had sanitation before. They had 5 people in a house before. Now they're in a big tent or a big shelter or a big camp, and you have thousands of people together. You have poor sanitation. You have tents that don't have good windows, so the ventilation isn't good. You know, I just got back from the Bahamas, and there was 1,000 people in 1 gymnasium, all open air, all using the same 10 toilets. So that has a real chance then to spread diseases a couple different ways. One would be, you know, through use of the common toilets, if there's a GI bug that's going around like norovirus or something like that. And the other possibility is respiratory illness like diphtheria and pertussis spread when there's a lot of people in close quarters.
Wasn't there a big cholera outbreak in Haiti after the earthquake?
Haiti did have cholera brought to the country. It hadn't been in this hemisphere in 100 years. It was brought here by UN soldiers from Nepal. And they dumped their cholera-infested shit in the river, which then, surprise, infected lots of people. There's been about 10,000 dead over the last 9 years from the cholera that the UN brought there. So it wasn't a direct result of the earthquake that caused it. It was the fact that the UN was there partially in response to the earthquake that led to the cholera and death of 10,000 people in Haiti. The other thing that happens in disasters, it happened in Haiti in 2010, there was a diphtheria outbreak in the tents. And it only ended up being 5 or 6 cases, but in a place like Haiti that has low vaccination rates for diphtheria, it's a real opportunity to spread, and they needed the immune globulin. And so we actually had to go to the WHO warehouse in Haiti, didn't have any paperwork, just kind of busted in and said, we need some immune globulin for diphtheria. And to their credit, we left with a cooler full of immune globulin and inoculated a couple dozen people, the ones who were sick and suspected to be sick. You know, so there was even though it was a small epidemic or small outbreak, I wouldn't call it epidemic, that, you know, we were able to contain it. And not that I played a major role in it, but that there was the international community coming together to kind of snuff it out as best and as quickly as we can.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So while I've been off making movies about ghosts inhabiting cabins and meta found footage things and movies about guys crapping themselves on dates, my brother's been off saving people's lives in third world countries for the last 20 years. So you can imagine what that's done to my ego.
It's really impressive. You know, anybody who works as a doctor or a nurse or healthcare specialist, I'm impressed by any of those people. But somebody who literally throws themselves into a part of the world that is currently has an outbreak or it's just, I couldn't do it. I'm just amazed. I mean, it's beyond impressed. It's just like, it's almost like another level because I literally don't have the bravery to do what you do. And so I'm just truly impressed by, you know, not only just medical doctor devoting your life to helping other people, but, you know, going overseas where people really need help. It's an impressive thing. You and your colleagues should be really proud of yourselves.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. I think it's funny as we're watching these movies, the thought going through my head was, yeah, you know, they talk about needing volunteers at the hospital, and there's no question in my mind I would volunteer. But some of that's bravery, some of that's stupidity, for sure.
There's definitely some stupidity involved.
You know, some of it's self-destructive, but for sure some of it is based in facts. And I think when you have the facts on things, you can feel comfortable. Like, you know, when you're going to fight Ebola in West Africa, that when you're wearing the proper suit, the transmission rate is really, really, really low. It's not zero, but it's low. I was actually at the center of the swine flu, the H1N1 outbreak in 2010 in New York. I don't know if you guys recall, the U.S. epicenter of it was New York City. A bunch of kids went to spring break in Mexico and brought it back to New York City from there. So we had a whole lot of pregnant women. We had transplant patients all getting sick. And I was in the ICU that month, taking care of. And a couple of my colleagues ended up coming down with H1N1.
Was that during your residency at
It was during Columbia? Residency at Columbia. Yeah, I was in my residency. So, you know, we're living 100 hours a week in the ICU. Not getting much sleep, drinking too much coffee, and being exposed to this virus. But the good thing is the vaccine came out while I was on the rotation, and we were the first to be vaccinated.
So you were the Lawrence Fishburne of that situation.
I am Lawrence Fishburne.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. I mean, we could just talk about Dr. Vince's experiences around the world, and that would be a fascinating enough show. But we're here to talk about two movies that deal with disease, outbreak, contagion, pandemic, call it what you will. And we're going to start with a film called Outbreak, starring Dustin Hoffman as a doctor / G.I. Joe / authority figure who can do literally anything. The entire world is essentially saved by Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak. And the basic plot is that there is a cute little capuchin monkey who has been stolen by Patrick Dempsey, and the monkey gets loose and it's carrying a horrible disease, and anybody who comes into contact with it gets really sick. Thus begins a long and silly but very entertaining mishmash of cliches and tropes in which Dustin Hoffman and Cuba Gooding have to stay ahead of the disease at every point. Vince, real quick, just a yes or no. Is Outbreak remotely realistic?
Yes.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. Okay.
Emphasis on the remotely or the realistic?
That's a good way to start. What is the, in your professional estimation, what is the most realistic and unrealistic things about Outbreak?
I think with any of these virus movies, the most unrealistic thing right off the bat is generally the speed with which things spread. But I understand that's a cinematic tool. They could just make it say, instead of, well, it takes 2 weeks to spread around the whole globe, it would take, you know, 6, 8, 12 months to spread. You know, in cinema time, you could still have it pass over 15 minutes. But for sure, in both these films, it spreads quite rapidly around the whole globe. And even in, 12 Monkeys and World War Z and I Am Legend and all these kind of peripheral movies that have had viruses going around the world, they sweep through rather quickly. And so the thing that makes it difficult is the more deadly, more rapidly deadly a virus is or a disease is, the more likely it is to flame out.
Yeah, so he Dustin Hoffman mentions that at one point in the movie when she talks about how short the incubation period is and how quickly it's and that it's 100% fatal. He's like, oh, that's good news for us because, you know, people will die before they have had a chance to spread it to too many people.
Right. So, or something versus something like HIV, which has killed 30 million people globally over the last 30 years. It takes it 15 years to kill you. You know, so you have lots and lots of time to spread it to lots and lots of people, which, by the way, if I could interject, now that I brought up HIV, patient zero, you know, that term that we use, patient zero, it's actually patient O, meaning like the letter O for out of California. And it refers to a homosexual flight attendant from Canada in the early 80s who spread HIV to at least 40 people of the first 250 people. So while he wasn't the quote-unquote index case, we know he was a major kind of a super spreader of it, and that's how the term patient zero came along, even though it's patient O. But now we talk about patient zero. Contagion, they actually call it the index case, which is the correct term. In Outbreak, I think they do use patient zero.
Yeah, so from what I read, HIV actually goes back to like the 20s, the oldest cases.
That's an interesting, like, what is the actual... are we able to trace the definite origin of the HIV virus?
Yeah, so we what they do is they just use genetic mutations, the rate at which the virus mutates, and they trace that back to, okay, we know it does a number of mutations every X period of time, and we know that this is the original virus that we had in, you know, they found blood samples of HIV in a World War II pilot. They found evidence of it in some other periods around that time, and they know the mutation rate. So they can calculate it back, and it's probably in the 1890s, 1910s, along the Congo River is where it started. And the Congo River obviously is a hub for transportation, and there was a big hub for logging, and then also with that comes prostitution and everything else. And then,
so it jumped from monkeys, right? It was a simian virus, and then
presumably it was a simian virus that then
people, yeah, and the blood infected them. And
right, same with Ebola. It's a lot of there's a lot of bush meat eating. You know, bush meat is primates and those kind of larger animals, and the primates had SIV, the simian virus, and they also have, you know, Ebola, and then that's how it jumps to, jumps to humans.
Right. Now, let's talk a bit about what they cover in Outbreak a lot, the idea of a virus being airborne. Okay, now there are two, maybe three, pretty nifty tracking shots in this movie, which director Wolfgang Petersen is clearly very proud of. One of them shows like an expulsion of phlegm or mucus, and then leads us into an air conditioning vent in a facility. And then there's another one in a movie theater in which somebody coughs, and we get to follow the virus. Now, is that scientifically accurate? How an airborne virus could take flight?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things we'd call the. Technically, there's droplet and then there's airborne. And droplet is like the flu. And that means you have to have what is like a visible droplet. When someone sneezes, you see the saliva come out. That's droplet.
Got it.
Airborne is more like tuberculosis, and you'd have to have a different kind of mask that kind of seals in your face. That's actually kind of more contagious and, you know, harder to spread. But obviously droplet is, you know, we're so exposed to each other. Measles spreads by droplet. The flu spreads by droplet. So kind of all of these things that we know of that we're familiar with spread by droplet. And it would make sense that that's how it would spread. Not only airborne, but then you sneeze, touch your, you know, cover your mouth. Then you touch a doorknob. Next person touches the doorknob. So,
One of the things that jumped out at me, one of my scientific nitpicks with Outbreak right off the bat, was they go to this village in Africa, and Cuba Gooding Jr. freaks out because he sees this sick kid and he pukes into his containment suit, and then, you know, they beg him, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Kevin Spacey are like, don't take it off, don't take it off, and he pulls off his helmet. And they think, oh, crap, now he's going to get this disease. And the African doctor walks in, and he's not wearing a suit at all, and he says, oh, don't worry, it's not airborne, which, like, they don't even know what this thing is yet at this point. How could he possibly know whether or not the virus transmits airborne? Am I right about that? And how do we ultimately determine whether something can be, transmitted via blood, via droplets, via airborne? Like, how do we determine what the modes of transmission are?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same thing. I would certainly be having a surgical mask on at any point, at the very least. Maybe not the full, you know, Outbreak Ebola suit, but the simple surgical mask, or the what we call the N95, those masks that kind of cover the mouth a bit more. I would definitely have those on. I don't understand how he would know that it's not airborne, which I think he was also may have been wrong. You know, they talk about it starts as just contact, and then later on it mutates into respiratory. But it could have been respiratory all along, and they just got it wrong. Realistically, the way you'd know is contact tracing, meaning, all right, this person got it. How did they get it? Did they have sexual contact with the previous person? Did they have, you know, close contact, like sharing glasses or forks, or did they have, you know, just casual contact?
What did they call it in contagion when the surface contact? They had a word for it.
Fomite.
Fomite.
So fomite is anything that can transmit it. So the doorknob, the telephone, the elevator button, your cell phone.
Is that with a PH or an F?
F-O-M-I-T-E.
Now, another question that I thought, this might be a real simplistic question, but I am the layman on this. So is it realistic that a human could get sick from a disease that a monkey is carrying? Or does the fact that it's a different animal kind of preclude that?
Yeah, so that matters for sure. We all have markers on our cells that are self and non-self, right? So this is human, this is not human. This is Vince DiGennaro's DNA, that's Steve DiGennaro's DNA. And so our immune systems recognize ourselves. The some of what they recognize then is interspecies, right? So the virus, let me back up. The virus then recognizes those things on us and says, okay, this is how I'm going to get into your cells, right? And that protein on the envelope or of the cell, the entrance point to the cell, is what's can be unique in certain species. So obviously we're close to the monkeys, we share a lot of DNA, and there'd be certain things that could easily pass. But most things like the respiratory cell of a monkey and the respiratory cell of a human aren't going to have as many of these markers on them that allow the virus to get in. So, but we do know that regularly bird flu, swine flu, Ebola coming from bats.
Like I said, simian SIV.
SIV becoming HIV. So that simian SIV becoming HIV was mutation. What usually happens is you have bird flu, which is flu that infects birds, the gut and the respiratory tract of birds, passing into a human, and we are incidental hosts, meaning it generally doesn't spread from person to person there because it's not that virus isn't planning on us. We just kind of got there by accident. So the virus prefers breeding in the pig or the bird or the monkey. So not certainly not impossible, and it regularly happens. But what makes it then less likely is human-to-human transmission after that. That's where the big jump occurs because this virus has to find it got into one person, but then it has to mutate in order to pass from person to person. There has to be a mutation that allows that. And obviously there's millions of copies of viruses and one of them makes a mistake and that mistake is beneficial on an evolutionary scale and it can then invade another person. But generally for that to happen, you need to have lots of events. And to have lots of events, you want to have more than one person infected. So you want to have a monkey infecting 100 people, and only one of those 100 is going to actually have the virus that mutates and becomes passable between human to human.
Well, so this would this in part explain why, even though SIV mutated into HIV sometime in the late 19th, early 20th century, that it wasn't until the end of the 20th century that it started really transmitting from human to human, or was
no,
it?
I think that, so HIV is a special case.
All blame it on that one guy.
You blame it on that one guy because that is the reason HIV didn't become aware of it was of where it was happening, Central Africa, right, where the life expectancy was 30 anyway, right? So people were dying of a pneumonia and, you know, that was normal there. So that took a long time for it to reach San Francisco, and then you had healthy young men in San Francisco who happened to be gay dying of pneumonia in their 30s. And then that was, why is that? So the disease was there for decades, but we didn't ask the question because it was poor Africans whose life expectancy was 30 anyway were dying of it.
Is that still the case, that their life expectancy is 30?
It's now crept over 40s. And it's so that was, I mean, 100 years ago, for sure. I mean, the life expectancy in the United States in the 1890s was 40. So, you know, we've made tremendous advances in the last 100 years. Now in Africa, it's like, depending on the country, high 40s, low 50s. And mostly that's was being kept down by HIV. Now that it's a fully treatable disease, that's, you know, we're starting to see that, you know, have an impact.
Depressing and a little hopeful. I didn't know that it was that low. Gosh, it's scary. Yeah. All right. So Steve and Vince, just as scientists, as guys who are like watch a scientific movie analytically, what do you think of Outbreak as far as like just regular veracity? Just is it completely ridiculous, half ridiculous, or what?
Well, so, you know, I'll throw in my thing. Obviously, my brother knows a lot more about this than I do. It felt like a very Hollywoodized version of a story that at its core was kind of, you know, mostly plausible, but a lot of the details were fudged.
Here's a better question. Does Outbreak seem to be based on any specific historical event, however loosely?
No, I think Contagion is more, because Contagion looks a little bit more like the Spanish flu of 1918 in terms of the global spread and those kinds of things. I think this is very isolated. And let me take that back. I think it looks like Ebola, right? And so 1995, you know, Ebola has been known to us since the mid-70s, occurring in Uganda and Central Africa. And the movie really looks, you know, it's hemorrhagic. People's insides get liquefied. That's what Ebola does. You know, they cry blood tears.
Vince, I have that phrase, organs liquefying. I have it written in my notes. And I just had to ask you, let me interject real quick. How does a solid just liquefy? What is it? What is the process?
Yeah, it actually does. And Gwyneth's brain in Contagion also liquefies, presumably. Your organs are made up of proteins,
and in real life as well.
Yeah. Poor Gwyneth, her head up, ends up ends up in a box in Seven, and then her brain gets liquefied in this.
Her brain turned into goop.
Yeah. No, I mean, your organs are made of proteins, and the virus inhibits your cell's ability to make those proteins, and the structure just breaks down.
I mean, your body's 70% water to begin with, so like once you lose the cell structure that's holding all that water in and the organ structure that's kind of keeping it all organized, if you start ripping open those cells, then yeah, basically it's just a bunch of liquid at that point.
That also, and it's hemorrhagic, right? So then you start bleeding out of everywhere. Your liver is very vascular. Your spleen is very vascular, meaning there's a lot of arteries. And so you just bleed out of those things and they're going to look like a big red bloody sponge.
All right, so this brings up one of my biggest issues with Outbreak, which was, you know, spoiler alert at the end, you know, the ending here. So the gist of the whole thing is that Dustin Hoffman is, you know, spends most of the movie trying to locate this monkey, because if he can find the monkey, they can synthesize an antidote, you know, which is a very typical sort of Hollywood thing. So I have two points/questions that my brother can speak on. You know, one of them is the kind of ridiculousness of this idea that Outbreak gets wrong that I think Contagion gets right, which is that even when you find the monkey and the monkey has antibodies to this thing, that going from that to a vaccine or an antidote that you can give to people is not a process that takes hours, which is what it kind of does in Outbreak, but a process that takes months or years. And then the other one, which really bugged me, was that even if you find a way to kill this virus, half of Rene Russo's organs have already liquefied or have, you know, severe damage to them. Killing the virus is not going to reverse that. I mean, they show Kevin Spacey bleeding out of his eyeballs. Like, even if he gets something that kills off the virus, he has still got, you know, he's probably still going to die, or at least he's going to need.
Right. Yeah. She's not recovering. What you're saying is she's not.
It's not going to be better tomorrow.
That's a good question, Doc. Would she recover from that, or would she be too far gone?
No, you'd have to be in an ICU with, you know, on a ventilator for breathing and on dialysis to help your kidneys and, you know, all these kinds of things until your organs did recover. They would recover, but it would take, you know, it depending on the person being healthy and all this other stuff. But
it'd take months.
A healthy young Rene Russo who just, you know, went into liver and kidney shock as a result of this virus. Yeah, it could take her months to get better. By the way, two things I want to nitpick on Outbreak. They say that it's in Zaire in 1967.
It was Democratic Congo.
Yeah, Democratic Republic. It became Zaire in 1971. Small nitpick, but I'm an Africophile.
No, so they should get. How hard is it to get that right? Come on, that's a good nitpick.
You know, that's a historical nitpick. And then the other things in terms of like that I think they got wrong in Outbreak that they got right in Contagion. It's just they did their homework in terms of like we said, 100% case fatality rate.
Yeah, is that a thing Outbreak that even exists? Is there any disease that's 100% fatal?
Rabies.
On those kinds of timescales?
Rabies is. Okay. And you'd be dead within, you know, 2 weeks of getting rabies.
Of showing symptoms, but
You could not have rabies for months, right. Yeah, depending on where you got bit. Ebola has had 100% mortality rates, but that's in Central Africa where they didn't have good medical care or whatever else. The most recent outbreak was like 60% mortality rate or case fatality rate. So still high, but generally one that's 100% that has a two-day incubation period will flame out in days.
Right, and that kind of ironic from a doctor's point of view, which is it sounds weird, but yeah, if something has a short incubation and 100% mortality rate in a sick way, that's a good thing.
I'm trying to remember now, having watched both of these movies in the last 12 hours, I'm trying to remember what the opening of Outbreak starts in the past, and they, you know, firebomb village. But then how does the virus get out of
the monkey
out of Africa?
Yeah, the monkey. Oh, gets
the monkey.
Kidnapped,
right, right, right.
Sold.
The monkey gets kidnapped.
I call it the MacGuffin. The monkey is a MacGuffin in that movie because, all right, Vince, here's a question: do they have to find the monkey in order to be able to generate a vaccine?
No, not at all. But I guess it'd be helpful because realistically, the more kind of types of the virus that you find, the better you're going to understand its mutation rate. So you have some virus from, say, Kevin Spacey that you can study already. You don't need the monkey for that. The monkey would be helpful to know, okay, what was the strain that came over? And we can see the mutation rate between the monkey and Kevin Spacey, for example.
In the movie, weren't they trying to find the monkey because the monkey had antibodies?
So that's one thing. They show two monkeys there's two monkeys in the pet store. One of them drops dead. So that monkey...
No, it ends up living.
No, there's not the outbreak monkey does. There's one partner.
No, but the other one in the pet store.
They show him dead.
No, because they give him something and he comes back alive. That's how they know that.
Oh, that it works.
Later in the movie, yeah, like they some.
Okay, so that's the other thing, Scott. You asked about viruses jumping between people and animals. Generally, some of these things, you know, like Ebola doesn't kill bats. You know, they just kind of exist with it. And same, you know, whereas, say, rabies does. And SIV didn't kill the monkeys, actually. So there are different kind of viruses that may not kill the animal but would kill a human. Again, humans just being an incidental host, we're not part of their evolutionary strategy to replicate and survive.
One nitpick that I saw early in the film, and I think you'll both agree with me, another one of Wolfgang Peterson's lovely tracking shots, kind of gives us a tour of various labs.
It says
level one, and it gives the list of like relatively minor diseases, and then it goes level two, level three. And every one of these labs is just separated by an open door.
Well, they're wide open and people are walking back and forth.
As if it's a regular hospital ward, walking in and out of each,
like the whole conceit of that tracking shot is that they're following people from out of one lab and into the other lab. And I'm like,
right. And I'm thinking, all right, maybe not level one, but beyond level two, you're locking that door. That's in its own separate wing. What are you doing?
So one of the things that getting a little bit ahead, I talking about these two movies together, I think they were a really interesting sort of contrast. One of the very small details that I really liked in Contagion that they didn't have an outbreak was the way that the suits functioned. So in Outbreak, they're just wearing the suits. In Contagion, you can see that the suits are puffy, like they're, you know, there's positive pressure, right? Yeah. So they're being filled up with air, so they kind of blow up a little bit like a balloon. And the reason why they do that is so that if air does leak or whatever, that the air is being pushed outward constantly so that germs aren't going to be able to come in.
Oh.
Which is a plot point, actually, in Outbreak, is it not? Because Kevin Spacey's suit gets torn. Yeah.
It is. So there's a hole in the suit. It's, Vince, tell us a little bit about what these suits are like in real life, because we see them in movies all the time. So tell us what like if you had to go, God forbid, into a, you know, disease-ridden area in a poverty-stricken country and you had to be like maximum cautious. What do these suits do? What are they made of? You know, give us a little rundown.
Yeah, and they cover it in duct tape. The hole he has in his suit, and that's exactly what you do, is you would cover it with duct tape. That's like this WHO recommendation is to MacGyver the suit with duct tape. So yeah, I mean, you're supposed to put there. They can be made of Tyvek. They can be made of they're all like space age materials. It's not just straight up rubber like it would have been back in the day. But what they are all is impermeable, and they're impermeable not only water, because a water molecule is a certain size, but you want to go, you know, they have to be impermeable to viruses as well.
Yeah.
So
which have a wide range of sizes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there are masks that go to certain microns of you know, virus length and size, and certain that, you know, others that are. You know, those are pretty realistic.
Is there like a general safety suit, or are there very specific ones for a specific kind of outbreak?
Well, those are all BSL-4, like what you saw in, so in Outbreak, you could use those for Ebola, but realistically what we used was something a bit simpler where, again, you just put on kind of double impervious hairnets and goggles, and then you duct tape the goggles to the impervious Tyvek suit. So they don't have to be necessarily that thick, although obviously in Liberia in the middle of the day, it's going to be pretty damn hot. And you walk in, you dress other people, you both check each other for holes. Then there's chlorine sprayed on the ground where in kind of the vestibule and all these outdoor Ebola containment units.
So what happens when you come out? Because that was the other thing that I think both movies,
they showed it. They showed him getting showered off a little bit. And so you would, in a BSL lab, you fully definitely get showered with like hot steam and then disinfectants. Out in the field for Ebola, they had chlorine spray. And so it's a fine mist of chlorine. You spray each other with chlorine. Then you go into a vestibule. You take off the first layer. Then you go into another room and take off the second layer. So you have two layers of gloves on. You generally only have one suit on and one set of goggles. But your hands and your feet are the things that are going to contact surfaces the most. And those are double gloves.
I know this is probably a very layman's question, but what is it that chlorine actually does? Most people know chlorine as the chemical that will keep your swimming pool germ-free. But beyond that, what is – because it sounds like chlorine is like an essential component of your job.
Yeah. Whatever you do, it's chlorine for sure. And if you want to wipe out bloodstains so that the murder investigator can't see it, you need to, you know, clean it up with chlorine as well. It's just it's kind of like a strong base, and that just kills everything. Is the bottom line. It's like a super strong acid. I know people understand acid more than they understand base, but it's a strong base that would just, that kills everything.
I mean, it's the principal component of bleach. That's what, you know, chlorine bleach. That's what it is.
It's also mustard gas.
Yeah, I can answer this question a little bit, probably a little bit better, because that's a physics question almost as much as it is a biology
chemistry.
Yeah, it's a chemistry thing. So chlorine, if you remember your high school chemistry class, chlorine has 7 out of 8 of its shells filled, and so it really, really loves electrons, and so it tries to basically rip electrons off of other. It's very, very reactive with almost everything, because it's almost has a complete shell, but not quite a complete shell, and so it reacts with a lot of different things, and in doing so, you know, it will disrupt the biological aspects of proteins and viruses and whatnot.
Okay,
basically, like tearing it apart molecule by molecule is essentially what it is.
Vince, I wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts on Dustin Hoffman's performance as the heroic doctor. Do you buy him as the guy in this position? Have you ever commandeered a government helicopter, that kind of thing?
Not yet, but I'm only 40.
But he has. I have seen pictures of him on the helicopters.
I've ridden on plenty of helicopters for sure, all around Haiti. I run an emergency medical helicopter in Haiti, so I've ridden on plenty of helicopters, but never at the point of a gun. Now, I think Dustin Hoffman.
You've never stood down a bomber and gotten in its flight path to stop.
You've never played chicken with a stealth bomber, whatever it is. Yeah.
No, I've had cheap AK-47s pointed at me. That's it.
I mean, but again, we're making fun, but that's all the nonsense Hollywood stuff that makes the movie fun. And it is a fun movie. We're not trying to just, you know, nitpick it to death. But I just was like this. I had seen Outbreak in the theaters, and then I watched it again last week, and I'm thinking, this doctor does what like 14 people would do in real life. He does literally everything.
Yeah, not only that, I think he's kind of the typical arrogant rebel, right? I'm going to do things my way. They don't follow anybody's
nothing
rules.
Nothing like my little brother. Nothing right. Whatsoever at all like my little brother, who is not at all arrogant and not at all strong-headed.
Yeah, well, so I identify with myself personally more with a Morgan Freeman, who's quiet and measured and understands, you know, how to manage a room. You know, he balances managing Dustin Hoffman and Donald Sutherland at the same time.
You ever seen those memes where, like, what my friends think I'm like, what I'm really like? My brother thinks he's a Morgan Freeman, but he's really a Dustin Hoffman.
I don't see anything Dustin Hoffman-y about Vince, at least not yet, Stephen. But what do you guys think? Is it just a device? I mean, it kind of is essential to the movie, but it is kind of just a red herring, which is there's shady shit afoot, because Morgan Freeman and Donald Sutherland are trying to keep this outbreak a secret in some ways. So there's that whole subplot that in the real world probably wouldn't be a factor?
I would say the plot with the military weapon is a little over the top, but it's Hollywood, and it gave me goosebumps at the end when Cuba Gooding and Dustin Hoffman are staring down the C-130 coming at him, right? That was a cool ending. It was great.
Yep.
But I think more what would happen is the realistic stuff that does happen, which is the government tries to cover it up. In Contagion, the Chinese government covers it up. They underreport their statistics. They have to kidnap Marion Cotillard to be able to, you know, keep it under wraps. So those kinds of sinister things do happen. And, you know, we saw that with SARS and H1N1, where the Chinese government severely underreported it. Same with the Mexican government. We've seen that with MERS in Saudi Arabia, very underreporting it in order to keep it hush-hush. So the governments do have... there is a bit of mustache twisting in the evilness of governments when they come about with these kinds of viruses.
Well, all right, but how do you combat that as one of the people who has to save lives? Do you look at something and go, they're clearly underreporting this. We need to send somebody out there.
I want to answer quickly before he does with Dustin Hoffman's own answer to this question, which is, quote, idiocy is our only option.
Well, what he does, he goes to the press. They take a gun, they go into the nightly news, and they go on the air and they look for the monkey. So what I have done in the past is be a mouthpiece and be public, because people listen to a doctor, and they listen to a doctor in a crisis situation like that, and so you use that soapbox as a way to get the word out.
Isn't that how you got kicked out of Rwanda?
I got kicked out of Rwanda because of that. So
how, you know, so? This is a story. Tell us this.
Well, I was working as a cancer doctor in Rwanda, and the Rwandan government, which is an authoritarian government that committed genocide in the mid-90s, and, you know, they've been sketchy all along, they didn't want biopsies leaving the country, and I was having cancer patients, and I just took the biopsies outside the country in order that they could be read so we could treat the patients. And, you know, those kinds of things, didn't, you know, they didn't take too kindly to that. So although we saved some lives, they got pissed off at me. But, you know, I think those are the things you have to weigh when you are, you know, Doctors Without Borders giving out vaccines in Pakistan or Afghanistan. Like, how, do you work with the Taliban? Do you not work with them? There's these real conflicts with medicine and speaking out publicly about it. Is it better to be quiet and treat people, or to be public about it and maybe have them kick you out of the country, but then it's out and they have to do something about it?
It's scary to realize that you'd have some people actually opposing you while you're trying to, like, get to the bottom of a disease.
More than once. I've had, you know, in Haiti, the government overreported the death toll from the earthquake by a couple hundred thousand. They then underreported their death toll from the hurricane by a couple thousand. The Bahamas right now has a drastic underreporting of the death toll. And those are all political calculations because they have reasons to. One, Haiti in 2010 wanted donor money, so they overreported. Now the Bahamas doesn't want to get in trouble for having too many Haitian immigrants in shanty towns that got destroyed. And so they're going to underreport their numbers. So that kind of stuff happens in public health constantly. Public health and politics, you know, collide all the time.
Never do any of that. All right, let's wrap up Outbreak. I'll leave it to you guys. I think on an entertainment scale, it's got, you know, the ultimate 90s cast. I mean,
it's so 90s.
Imagine a 90s cast of more 90s than Dustin Hoffman, Rene Russo, Cuba Gooding Jr., Kevin Spacey, Donald Sutherland, Morgan Freeman, and Patrick Dempsey. That is the 90s defined right there. So I had a little bit of nostalgic fun revisiting this, and it moves fast. It is not, there's not a lot of fat on this movie, and it really moves forward quickly. It's kind of creepy. It's kind of fun as an adventure movie, but I think it plays kind of like it doesn't seem to have much in its brain. So for an entertainment value, I give it like a B-. And for scientific accuracy, I will see to the doctors on that.
I think the, you know, I wrote down a bunch of notes that aren't interesting for this audience, but things that I thought were, you know, I had to look up some things, whatever else. I want to nitpick two things. One,
feel free.
They fax something from an airplane in the middle of the movie. They fax some results. In 1995, okay? We had email in 1995. I had email. I was 15 years old and I had email. And they faxed it, and they faxed it from an airplane. So if you could wirelessly transmit the fax, why couldn't you email
just email it?
Yeah. This is the federal government.
This is 2019, and there are still people that make you fax. Like, I had to do Julian's vaccine records just a couple weeks ago to send them to his new preschool. And they told me I couldn't email it to them as an attachment. They said I had to either fax it to them or I had to print it out and bring it in. And I'm just like, are you kidding me?
So the other thing,
of HIPAA laws or something.
Yeah, it's HIPAA laws. It's privacy laws. The other thing I found super interesting, they do gene sequencing kind of immediately. It takes like 10 days, the gene sequence. We didn't map the whole human genome until 2000, right? And that was a monumental thing. So that wasn't possible to sequence the genes in even—
The virus has much fewer genes.
It does have fewer genes, but they did it in like a month. So it wasn't possible then in 1995. Interestingly, in 2012, in Contagion, they do it, they map it, and it is possible, and it is possible in 3 days. So that technology changed over 20 years that what was future-looking in Outbreak is now standard.
What was
Contagion.
Science fiction in 1995 is now science fact in 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's a good point. It's a good way to put it, Stephen. You guys wrap up Outbreak, and then we'll move on to Contagion?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, for me, I think Dustin Hoffman was over the top. I like kind of everybody else, and I thought it was entertaining. And they do stupid things like have a helicopter chase with Cuba Gooding Jr. and Donald Sutherland, you know. But taking that at face value, it was a good popcorn movie. I think the science is not nearly as good as Contagion, and I want to dock them not because the science was so bad, because they didn't do enough homework on kind of the basics that they should have done, like Cuba Gooding Jr. taking his mask off and the guy saying it's not airborne when it actually was.
So we do letter grades. So entertainment value and scientific intelligence. What would you give it?
I'd stick with a C+, B- for entertainment, and I'd go a C- for scientific.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it in the same way. I mean, it was very much a 90s disaster movie. It reminded me a lot of Volcano and Dante's Peak and 2012 and some of these other movies that we've covered on the podcast. Arachnophobia, which we haven't covered on the podcast, but I've watched recently. It has that, like, the camera work, like you said, the cast, it's very sort of, it's just so 90s, the whole thing. And, you know, it's entertaining in that sort of big, dumb, bombastic sort of way. that Dante's Peak was. So I will give it, you know, a B minus, I think, on entertainment value. And I'll just go with my brother's recommendation on the scientific intelligence. It's, you know, I think it's about right based on my own scientific knowledge that it's, you know, it's barely a C student.
What's fun about it is that it is, I think, the goal here from the producers on down and Wolfgang Petersen, I think the goal was, yeah, we want it to be scary, but not real scary. And they wanted to make it, like you said, Stephen, like a popcorn movie, like Dante's Peak, but with the disease instead of a volcano. Okay. And it has some dark moments, but it's mostly kind of a popcorn movie, like Vince said. And now when we get to Contagion, which came out in 2011, that seems to be like Steven Soderbergh and his writer, Scott Burns, saying, we want this to be actually scary. Like we want it to be realistic. It's still a movie, but it's, you could tell, even if you're a layman, you could tell they did their homework a lot more on this film.
So can I tell the story of what you said to me yesterday or whatever, Scott, where like, so, you know, Scott obviously has seen every horror movie ever made and doesn't get scared by very much, but was intimidated about having to watch this movie again because rightfully,
yeah,
it's terrifying.
I sometimes deal with anxiety and depression. And, you know, anybody who deals with those things knows that the weirdest things can set you off. Like a sad commercial can like just set off a domino effect of sad thoughts, you know. So when I'm having one of those bouts, I try to avoid excessively dark material. But obviously I had to do the show and I knew it wasn't going to kill me. So I sat down and revisited Contagion last night and it freaked me out. It is freaking scary. And you know,
it's scary because it's so plausible.
It's scary because it's real.
Right. Exactly.
I love the cast. I love that it unlike Outbreak, in which virtually everything has to rotate around the central doctor, Soderbergh and Scott Burns are smart in that this movie plays kind of like
an ensemble,
episodic. It jumps from one story to another story to another story. And those stories do tie together. But aside from maybe Brad Pitt in the first half of the movie, there is no one focal character. It jumps around. And I think that makes it a lot more interesting.
You mean Matt Damon?
What did I say?
He said Brad Pitt.
Same thing.
Another workout dreamy blue person. Eyes.
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon. My question to you, Vince, is how realistic is this movie?
Yeah, I mean, this is for sure. I mean, obviously Soderbergh does a much better job, I think, of holding suspense and building it, whatever else, but from a movie standpoint, but from a scientific standpoint, they did their homework for sure. They talk about it in epicenters. They talk about it spreading over months, right? I mean, the thing doesn't happen and there's no split second decision making. It's a slow motion tragedy. And it starts in big cities around the world and then kind of spreads from there.
Yeah, so that was one of the things about Outbreak that this movie gets right that Outbreak didn't. Because Outbreak, you know, they decided they wanted to set the whole thing in this one small town. And so, like, somebody gets this disease and so they have to quarantine this one small town. But that's, you know, and the ticking clock is if somebody gets out, it'll spread out to everywhere. Which seems very unrealistic to me, obviously, in the modern world with people traveling everywhere, you know, that anything that has even a remotely extended incubation period is going to spread to a whole bunch of different places really, really fast before you even know that it exists. Is that accurate? Is that
well? And that's and so. What happened with SARS, again, to go back to the Chinese government, because they show a cover up from the Chinese government in this, SARS was kept under wraps by the Chinese government for months. They didn't invite the WHO in. They didn't admit about their cases. And then when it got to Canada, Canada's like, China, what the hell, you know? And then we realize the full extent of it. And so that, you know, no, those things are, it can be a slow burn, a slow boil. These vaping illnesses that you're seeing on, you know, those come from the CDC collecting data slowly over time. Hey, we have one case in Minnesota, two in Rhode Island, whatever. So, you know, that's how you build a case. You know, this is interesting because they talk about the man on the bus in Tokyo, which is obviously spread, him being patient zero or the index case is spread by Jude Law's, you know, the muckraker TMZ type, which conspiracy turns out to be theorist. False. Yeah, the conspiracy theorist turns out to be false.
It was Gwyneth Paltrow all along.
Yeah, it was right. It was a woman that destroyed humanity.
A woman surprise. Who was cheating on her husband.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Good Lord. I don't know why we needed that little plot diversion there. It's hard to call it a fun movie, but man, it's intense. It is, you know, it is compelling, gripping, whatever. Like I was like both fascinated and impressed by the screenwriting, the acting. Obviously it's cut together like a dream, But I'm also like, I want this movie to end. I just want it to be over. I don't want to watch this story anymore. And my question to you, Vince, is when somebody comes out of a movie like Contagion and they're terrified, what do you say to them?
Get a shot of whiskey, I think, is the first thing I'd say. No, listen, these things are real. We get a global flu pandemic every 50 years or so. So it will happen again. It's just a question of, you know, we get a SARS, we get an H1N1, we get Ebola. These things will continue to happen because we're humans and there's evolution, whatever else. So they happen. It's just a question of being realistic about it, right? And so
well, one of the things, I mean,
don't panic.
The modern world has become, especially here in the first world, obviously you live in the third world, and so you have a very different view on these things. You're also sort of steeped in it, obviously, as well. You know, from the point of view of a first world person who, you know, when I get sick, my first thought isn't, oh crap. Well, my first thought is, oh crap, this is going to kill me because I have an anxiety disorder. But the normal reaction is not, this is a cold, maybe it's the flu, I'll be down for a couple of days and then I'll be fine. Because we don't encounter these kinds of deadly diseases all that often. Throughout most of human history, and even throughout most of the world today, you know, getting sick can kill you rapidly, and that's in some sense a part of life that you just have to deal with.
Yeah,
so I think it's scarier for us in a lot of ways because we're just not used to
insulated. We're insulated from death as an everyday occurrence, whereas I have a staff member in Haiti who has a death once a month. That's just the fact of life in those places. And in our country where the life expectancy is 80 and we all expect to live forever, then, you know, anything that was going to interrupt that plan is something that's super anxiety provoking. And since I also suffer from the De Janeiro family anxiety, I get that. But I think the movie did a really good job of building the suspense. And from a scientific point of view, I thought they did a great job with showing things unfolding in real time. I paid attention to a lot of little details. 47 cases, 8 dead. Then they had a 50% case fatality rate on the whiteboard later on. Then they say the case fatality rate is 25 to 30%. You know, so the numbers are constantly changing. They talk about it as a bird flu at first, and then they talk about it as a chimera, and then they talk about it as a bat and pig mixture. Right. And so very clearly the quote-unquote experts are just fumbling their way along in this and that's what would really happen. So that kind of, for me, helped put a sense of chaos and impending doom over the film.
Yeah, they kind of seem to know what it is right away. They look at they look at it once, they sequence its genes, and they're like, all right, well, now we know what this thing is. It came from a monkey.
Well, it also comes back to smart writing. In Outbreak, it's, you know, let's call it 100% fatal because that's scary. But on Contagion, it's, hey, it's scary enough. You know, the number 25 to 30% might not sound as scary as 100, but if you're really watching the movie and getting the information they're giving you, that's plenty scary. That's 1 out of 3 people.
Well, so one of the things that jumped out at me, this wouldn't be true so much for Outbreak because Outbreak, you know, they do posit that it's 100% fatal. But one of the things that I kind of would have liked to have seen maybe a little bit or had some sense of was because everybody we do see get it in Contagion dies. Like everybody that we care about, everybody – like they say it's 20 to 30% fatal, but Kate Winslet dies.
Except for Jude Law. Jude Law lives.
But Jude Law never had it. At the end, they say that he never had it. They say he faked the whole thing. And so we don't ever see sort of like, well, okay, so the people that don't die from this thing, what does that look like? What does the treatment look like? What does their prognosis look like? What happens to them? And I guess I'm asking this of my brother, sort of like.
So the cool thought I had of this, and they use the serum in Outbreak. In Contagion, they use a vaccine. What they did for Ebola, the last most recent Ebola, was they took the serum, the blood of people who survived Ebola that then had antibodies against Ebola in it and gave it back as a treatment to other current patients. And it worked.
Just like a blood transfusion?
Yeah. I mean,
you take out the
plasma that has the antibodies in it and they transfuse the plasma. So, you know, they were doing that.
Are you able to replicate those antibodies or does it have to be from the net?
No. Well, at that point, we couldn't. At that point, we're using humans as their own replicating. So when they evacuated a couple American doctors back to Boston from Liberia, they gave them serum from people who had survived an Ebola outbreak in 1995. So there's some of that going on in the real world. And same thing that, you know, the vaccine you see for Ebola that's out there already, we made it in like 2 years. So when the whole world wants to do something, get behind it, it's possible.
So yeah, they bring that up in the movie. Matt Damon is like, well, if I have antibodies to this thing, can't you just use my antibodies? And Kate Winslet says, you know, like that would be impractical and ridiculously expensive because there's not really any way to I mean, I suppose they could kill Matt Damon and take all of the antibodies out of him, but like barring
you want him
that,
alive. You lock him in a cage and just force him to produce antibodies. I
mean, you can only give blood, you know, a pint of blood every couple weeks or something, right? So like,
so Matt Damon is actually what they posit in the movie is that he's immune, not that he got it and then recovered. I think that he's genetically immune. So actually, there are people who are genetically immune to HIV, and we have used that fact that where they're genetically immune to make new classes of drugs.
So what makes, that's one of my questions I had on my list, was what makes some people immune to a thing versus some people that get it but live versus some people that get it but die. Obviously there's, you know, a health differential probably broadly between the people, you know, healthy people are less likely to die than, you know, old or young or sick people, but even healthy people obviously in this movie die from it, but some of them do and some of them don't. Like what are the factors that make somebody immune or make somebody more susceptible to dying from a thing than other people?
Yeah, I mean, it's genetic variation, right? And this is what you want in a population. So it doesn't, you know, your whole orange crop can get wiped out by one virus if you have the same plant. But if you have different plants with different genes in them, they're going to mix. And so on this level, you know, you and I only share 50% of our DNA. And if, 25% of our DNA, you have these proteins on your cells that allow things to enter the cell. So one person may have a protein that allows it to enter, and one person may have a mutated one that doesn't allow it to enter. Those are the kinds of things that would keep one person from being immune. And then, you know, then you have the interpersonal factors as to who's, you know, seen what viruses before in their lifetime, those kinds of things, and how healthy they are. But if for sure, this happens all the time. Totally healthy people just, you know, drop dead of certain viruses, and other people don't really get that sick from it. Like I said, I took care of people who are dying of H1N1, and I had colleagues who had H1N1, were out for 3 days and came back.
Vince, I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about the actions and the realism or the believability of the Marion Cotillard character. She plays Dr. Leonora Orantes, and she is, like you, an epidemiologist who works for the World Health Organization. And I'm watching the movie, and I'm like, all right, this is Vince. This is him. It's a woman, but that's him. So, like, what do you think about her depiction, her portrayal?
Yeah, it's funny. The Kate Winslet had a job that I was offered but turned down at the CDC. It's an epidemiology intelligence officer. So the Kate Winslet character is somebody who goes out and investigates epidemics, and often they do get sick from it. Marion Cotillard as well, you know, but they also were the people who were instrumental in starting vaccinations for polio in the 70s or in places like Africa and Asia.
They're like the disease detectives. They're like the Columbo disease who shows detectives. Up and says, yeah. Hey, those three people are sick. They slept in that hut. That guy over there is sick. I got to make the connection between them and then figure out what the disease is. And that's kind of the Kate Winslet role.
Who shared glasses with who and who just was at a movie theater together with who. That's kind of how you trace the stuff back. And it's labor intensive work. You know, you got to go visit people's houses. You got to make lots of phone calls. So, that stuff is boring, and they made it seem relatively exciting. Although they allude to it a little bit with Kate Winslet
I'm
sitting
sure
in
the
room
more exciting
with
when,
Matt Damon.
When it's like life or death of the entire world, when the stakes are like 60 million people are going to die, I'm sure it's considerably less. It feels less of a grind, I would imagine. But
I mean, the CDC with the vaping thing, they found out that the vitamin E additive to the THC vapes, you know, they found that out in a matter of weeks. And that's all contact tracing. Then they took all their vials, took them back to a lab, tested them, found the one thing that they had in common, and it was vitamin E. You know, so that was the CDC. Those are the disease detectives. That's what they do. It's really, really cool.
So I had a couple of questions for the doc, the other doc. So the scene that I remembered most from this movie, so I saw it in the theater when it came out. I haven't seen it since then, and so this morning was the first time I've watched it again. And the scene that stuck with me, which I thought was later in the movie, and it's really in the first like 5 or 6 minutes, is so Gwyneth Paltrow dies, and the doctor has to come out and tell her husband, Matt Damon, that she's dead. And he's like, but she was just fine yesterday. What are you talking about? Like, she can't possibly be dead. And that just the sort of denial that he goes through and that whole conversation felt so real to me that moment has stuck with me for 8 years or whatever since I watched this movie the first time. I'm curious to ask my little brother, as somebody who has had to deliver that news to people before, probably many times, that either that they're dead or that somebody they love is dead or that person themselves is dying. How realistic was that conversation? How realistic was his reaction to it in the moment? How did that read to you?
No, that was, I get a little PTSD here, you know, watching that, because it was perfect. You know, what you do is you be very direct. I'm sorry they're dead. I have some bad news for you. I'm sorry they died. And you get it out there so there's no suspense, and that the whole rest of the conversation then can proceed from that point, which is what the doctor did. You give them a little space to talk if they want it. Generally, they might not. They just want you to talk more and fill in the gaps of what the hell and how. And the doctor does that. And he actually goes through the differential diagnosis of West Nile and encephalitis. And, you know, he talks about, he does a good job of talking out his own thoughts as to what he thinks killed the patient. But at the same time, you're also then explaining to the family member a little bit of what you know, that, you know, I don't really know why they died. And, we get that not infrequently. I don't really know. They were sick and whatever.
This was one of the first movies where I thought, wow, Matt Damon is better than just that, you know, wise-ass kid from Good Will Hunting. I remember that sequence in particular because it's in the trailer, and I've seen that trailer 10, 12, 14 times. And the doctor says, I'm sorry, she's dead. And without missing a beat, Matt Damon says, well, let me talk to her.
Yeah.
and the doctor says, I'm sorry, she died. And it's like that one exchange just breaks your heart, because it's not only something that obviously everybody goes through, that instant denial, but his performance is so low key and so scared. It's just a great, great performance by Matt Damon.
It's a fantastic piece of writing and a fantastic piece of acting.
When he veers very quickly to near verbal violence with the doctor, right? And that is also happens, like the very placid denial, and then anger comes out right away, and this must be somebody's fault, and you're the person sitting there in front of him. So, you know, really, that was a really good portrayal, and the doctor kept his calm. That was a very accurate portrayal of that situation. Thought they did it. And the writing, I think, was spectacular.
Now, if, say, we're watching Contagion, and I look over at you, Vince, and I say, all right, is this realistic? Could this happen in the States now?
It happens every year. It's called influenza.
Okay.
So, you know, we have somewhere, I can't remember the figures off the top of my head, but there's tens of thousands of Americans die every year from the flu. They're generally older people, and that's why they get the flu vaccines, sometimes kids, HIV, cancer patients, those kinds of things. But it regularly happens. It's happening now with the friggin' measles outbreaks with these morons, the anti-vaxxers. So, you know, I think to pretend that we're past this is quite a bit of hubris. And I think—
No, I don't mean that we're past it. I mean something much more dire than influenza that we've had close calls with. But,
well, I guess on some level, no, I didn't mean you were being hubristic. I just think the anti-vax movement is actually hubris, based in the fact that people think we're past it. You know,
right.
Like the cervical cancer vaccine. I've run a cervical cancer program in Haiti, and I see the women die, and so no one knows anybody who's died of cervical cancer in forever, so they're not taking the vaccines. No one knows anybody who's died in measles. I've lost babies to measles in Rwanda and Uganda. So, you know, when you see those things,
I can only imagine, Vince. I mean, anti-vaxxers make people like me and Steven furious, but I can't even imagine how someone like you, who travels to third world countries and vaccinates and saves lives and sees people dying from treatable diseases without vaccines, I can only imagine how violently opposed you are to the anti-vax. And I give you free rein to rant on that topic if you'd like.
No, I don't want to rant. I want to say that I think that makes this milieu, though, is important to discuss, you know, an outbreak like Contagion, and then what would then falls is the downfall of society, right? They start rioting and looting, and people start hitting each other and all these kinds of things. I think the more unprepared for it we are on a cultural, psychological sense, then the more difficult it's going to be for us to deal with. And we're not. You know, the anti-vax stuff with measles and cervical cancer, that kind of demonstrates it to me, that we are unprepared culturally to deal with something like that. And I would have real doubts about our societal structure holding up, whereas a place like Haiti or Rwanda that is accustomed to death, their society would be fine. They would go on.
As fine as it is.
As fine as it is. Right. We would tear each other apart, I think.
Why do you think that some people become convinced that vaccines are either bad or unnecessary? Where does that thought process come from?
I think the big part of it is they have never known anyone who's died of any of these diseases. They've never even heard of anybody. Their grandmother had never heard of anybody who's died of these diseases. So they're so far from it that the perceived harm of the vaccine outweighs the perceived risk. Really what it is.
I can also tell you, as somebody that is, you know, deep into conspiracy theories in general, almost always the conspiracy comes first and then the belief comes second. So it's almost always a predisposition to believe that there are grand forces at work that are trying to kill you or kill your children or whatever else. I can't imagine if I had a child who turned out to be autistic, severely autistic in particular, like how difficult that would be to process. So I wouldn't want to judge any parents that
people want something to blame them.
They want exactly. So if that were to happen to one of my kids, you want it, there's a weird psychological way when human beings were like, we would rather believe that there are bad forces working against us than that it's just
random roll of the biological dice.
Right.
So I have a friend who has an autistic child. And with the second and third kid, they delayed their vaccines until they were like 2 or 3 years old. And so, you know, I think there's some discussion to be had in terms of like, is the vaccine schedule right and whatever else, and weighing your own personal versus societal. Certainly by the time any child enters school or daycare with around other kids, they have to be vaccinated. But if you're going to keep them at home until they're 4, all right, you know, that's your problem. But no, I think that all of this leads to what makes contagion so scary. It is literally what it is that, you know, keeps us up at night. Again, this wouldn't necessarily keep, say, the Haitians up at night because they deal with infectious disease all the time. For us, it's such a scary unknown that we.
It's the unstoppableness of it too that makes it so scary to me. It's like you imagine yourself in that situation and you think, okay, well, I could. At one point, Matt Damon barricades himself in his house and won't even let his daughter's boyfriend come in. But you still have to go out for food, and in the minute that you go out for food, you're now exposing yourself to other people. And like, I was thinking about that time. So he goes out at one point to go get the food from, you know, the MREs from the military. And he's the one that goes out because he's immune to the disease and she stays at home, but he's now potentially carrying that back home with him on his clothes and stuff. So when he comes in, does he have to like immediately remove all his clothes and stick them in the wash and shower himself so that he doesn't accidentally bring any germs back? And maybe there's some on his feet. And just that paranoia of like, you could just get sick and die in 2 days. I can't imagine, you know, if that was happening on a pandemic level, how difficult it would be as a first world person to function in that sort of environment and not grow paranoid and terrified.
Well, that's why we have quarantine, right? I mean, quarantine was the result of the plague in the 13th and 14th century, which is our ports are closed. We're keeping our four walls of our castle closed to you. And that's, you know, that actually had some merit and benefit to it, of course. Quarantine works. We know it works.
But you still rely – I mean, like it's that – to me, it brings up that sort of existential terror of like, I need other people in order to live. I can't subsist on my own. I don't know how to grow my own food. I don't know how to do my own medicine or whatever else. And so I need other people, but other people are potentially dangerous. You know, in this context, they could be carrying diseases. And that push-pull of living in a society and all of the benefits of it, but also the fears of it, when you bring those to the forefront, it's, you know.
Ted Kaczynski, Cabin Time.
Yeah, exactly.
pig plus bat DNA. Is that a believable explanation for the contagion in Contagion? At the end, we're seeing exactly how Gwyneth Paltrow got sick. I don't know if narratively, if that's really necessary, but it is an interesting kind of dovetail to bring the movie back to the beginning. Vince, what are your thoughts on the origin of the disease?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, what you generally have when we have swine flu and bird flu and that kind of stuff is you have a farmer who has 10,000 birds on their farm that they're constantly in contact with, and then one of them gives him a virus. And then, you know, like we said, he may get sick from it, but it generally doesn't go to other people. So, you know, the one bat dropping one thing to one pig, going to one chef who then infected one, you know, wealthy socialite in the casino in Macau, that wouldn't happen. No.
Well, but that is the one case where it worked. That's the whole point. Like that, it may have happened a million times before, and this is the one where it actually like transmitted and stuck.
I guess you would have had local cases though. The only, you know, just in the only part that's not realistic, you would have a local. There would be a local Hong Kong.
Right. The odds of it happening in that sequence are like hitting the lottery. It's one in a million kind of.
It would have gone to a Chinese or Macauian farmer first, and then the whole village would have gotten sick. Then the whole village would get sick, and then it would go outside the borders. You know, carried by travelers,
which is what happens in Outbreak. So Outbreak was more realistic in that regard. Well, yes. At least in the opening scene of Outbreak.
What Outbreak doesn't have that I think makes Contagion a lot better is that Outbreak is basically an adventure movie surrounding a disease. And Contagion occasionally goes outside and just shows the impact the quarantines and the conspiracy theorists online and stuff like that. And
trash on the ground.
Yeah, the civil unrest.
The empty airport and the malls being closed. Stuff like that is quietly very creepy.
All right, so we got to wrap this up.
Yep.
Vince, do you have anything other things from Contagion that you that jumped out at you as things that you...
No, I thought it was, you know, they talk about the numbers, which I thought was important. And, you know, they talk about 125 million dead at a certain point. So, you know, that is super scary. And in 2014 in Ebola, it was a million that was projected. Obviously, we, you know, it ended up being about 10 or 12,000. They mentioned 26 million dead later in the film. So it was a real impact, right? Like, even though all of humanity wasn't wiped out, you know, there people lost loved ones on that scale. And so I think at the end of the day, it was a... like triumphant but sad, you know, a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, and that's what life is anyway, right?
Yeah.
You're never going to have total victory. Everybody's going to lose a little bit of something.
Yeah, and the ending almost sort of reinforced that in this idea of like, okay, well, now we have a vaccine, but the whole world needs the vaccine, and you can't, you know, it takes time to manufacture that much vaccine, and so now we have to decide, okay, who gets it first? How do we decide who gets it first? What does everybody else do in the meantime? Does that cause problems, you know, people breaking into Lawrence Fishburne's house because they want to steal the vaccine because their lottery number is too low? And it brings up, you know, again, it feels realistic in a way that Outbreak obviously wasn't, because it was like, oh, we found the monkey. All right, that's it. Everybody's cured.
I flash back to, like I said, the H1N1 in New York when we were – I remember being in the room when they literally got the first batch of vaccines. I couldn't roll my arm up fast enough to get the vaccine. And, you know, because we were on the front lines, we got it first. But for sure, it was scary to be there. And having dealt with these kinds of things a bunch since, it still – I don't think gets any less scary. And I think, you know, you don't stop thinking of yourself. – And I think if I had a kid, I'd think of the kid first, you know. But it's just very realistic, very palpable. It felt like the fear in the movie.
Well, I hate to – I was debating this whole episode if I was going to ask this question, but I think our listeners might be interested. Vince, what is potentially – what is the next disease that you and your colleagues are looking at? Is there anything out there that we should be aware of, that we should be cautious of?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things, right? There's one, which is the ever-present, you know, China has a massive swine flu epidemic right now. They've slaughtered like a billion pigs, which I don't know, I mean, that really hasn't made international news, and that's only in the pigs. But like I said, at some point, it will jump from a pig to a human. At some point, the bird flu jumps from a bird to a human. So realistically, what it's important is the government's being honest and having good tracking systems in place. I think the other thing, of course, is climate change, and you're going to see these tropical diseases start climbing up, you know, and so we've had dengue in Florida for the first time in 100 years. And you have, there's a new
malaria,
encephalitis up in the Midwest right now. So those things are, again, they happen in real life. It's just a smaller scale, and climate change is allowing that to happen.
All right. So Scott, sum up your feelings on Contagion.
Contagion, as far as filmmaking, and I think it's an A-. I think it's an excellent movie that I never want to watch again. Kudos to Soderbergh and his crew. They did exactly what they wanted. It's sobering. It's entertaining, but it's also a gut punch. And for scientific accuracy, I will just guess A-, because it seems realistic to me.
Yeah, I agree on both of those. I think it's a solid A-. I hesitate to even call it entertainment value because, as you pointed out, it's not necessarily as entertaining so much as it is
compelling,
illuminating and compelling. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I remember being struck even back then with my limited knowledge of medicine with how much attention to detail they paid. And actually, incidentally, I met Scott Z. Burns. He came to do a guest lecture at UT when I was teaching the film department. And he talked a bit about how, you know, careful they were, like, from the, you know, from the ground up. It wasn't like, okay, let's write a story and then have somebody fact check it, which is how a lot of science fiction movies sort of get. You hire a consultant after the fact.
Right. Think of the story first and then wedge the science as you can around the story.
Right. And then the consultant's like, well, this wouldn't work and this wouldn't work and this wouldn't work. And then you're like, well, it's too late now. We already wrote a whole story around those ideas. So this, you know, they said the goal from the beginning was we want to make, you know, if this happened, what would it look like in real life? And I think they nailed
it. It seems like reality or veracity was one of the very first marching orders. And but I want to hear what Vince thinks.
Yeah, no, same thing. And, you know, seeing Kate Winslet die, you know, being doctor on the front lines, You know, I think that's super realistic. I love Soderbergh. Everything he does, I think, has been great. And he has like these mesmerizing films where you kind of jump in and the music is there and you can't ever extract yourself from it. You're present in it the whole time. And I think this was just another example of that. And instead of being a crime heist, it's a virus thriller. And on the science, yeah, like I said, I think they did a great job. My only bone to pick is that the initial, patient zero is, that would be somebody else. But it was a good way to bring it home to a white American audience that this disease is coming for you. So I give them A minus on both.
I'll tell you, Vince, after finishing Contagion, I just wanted to shake the hand or hug every single, not just doctor, but clinician, scientist,
nurse,
intern who works for the WHO, who works for the CDC, anyone who, is on the front line protecting us from these diseases. I mean, talk about unsung heroes. Wow.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who went to the Ebola outbreak in 2014. I couldn't go because of scheduling stuff, but I was also shit scared. I'm not going to pretend like I wasn't. But yeah,
I remember
him
telling me that he wanted to go.
Yeah, and I signed up. I just think
it was right after the doctor had contracted it. And my family was not a fan of that decision.
Well, yeah, my dad was a fireman, and he used to tell us stories about how he had to run into a burning building, and it's no different. You guys are like running into a virus, and kudos, man. Just like, thank you for all the work you do and your colleagues. I'm just grateful and impressed by the work you do, and the fact that you're like 12 years younger than me makes me sick, because I've wasted my life talking about movies while you're out in countries saving dozens and hundreds of lives. It's amazing to me.
Hey, Scott, you know what? When I'm in Haiti, I'm flicking through Twitter and I'm reading your tweets, so keep them coming.
Thanks.
But before we break, I will say that one of the only things that makes me feel a little bit less of a schmuck around my little brother is that we are currently working on a documentary about his cancer program in Haiti, and I'm hoping to use my filmmaking skills to bear to try to tell the world his story, so that
the story of the cancer patients.
Yeah, well, the story of the cancer patients and the program. And he's being humble. The program that my brother built from the ground up to save people's lives.
What is that program called?
It's going to be called Survivor, ironically.
The program is called Innovating Health.
Oh, Innovating Health International is Haiti's largest cancer program. But the movie is going to be called Survivor because it's about, beating cervical cancer in a place that doesn't have proper treatment.
Yeah, so if if you are listening to this and if you have a few extra dollars.
During Breast Cancer Awareness Month, might I add.
Yeah. You could go to innovatinghealthinternational.org and please give them a little bit of money. They're saving people's lives and doing good in the world, and I'm very proud of my brother.
Thank you.
I'm impressed. Thank you, Dr. DeGennaro, and thank you, Dr. DeGennaro. This has been a creepy but very illuminating episode. Next week, I hope we do something a little more light. But I'm glad that we got these two interesting movies paired up, and it was phenomenal, just excellent to have you with us, Vince. And I know we talked about it, but I think we're going to have you come back for World War Z versus I Am Legend in the future.
I love those two. Those we can just have a little bit more fun with.
Yeah, those we're not talking so much about realistic deaths and organs liquefying. We're talking about zombies and vampires. So I just want to thank you for all the work you do. Thank you for coming on the show. And I'll let Steven sign us off.
Thank you guys for listening. And thank you, Vince, for coming.
Thank you guys.